At a time like this, it's easy to see why local news is so important and why that news should be free for everyone who needs it to be. Your support of KCUR makes this essential reporting possible. If you can, please donate kcur.org/give. And thanks.
Good morning and welcome to up-to-date special coverage coronavirus in Kansas City. I'm Steve Kraske. Living not far from a state line, as most of us do, has given residents of eastern Kansas and western Missouri a bird's-eye view of how a Democratic governor is approaching the coronavirus and how a Republican governor is doing the same thing. We'll begin by looking at the responses of Kansas Governor Laura Kelly and Missouri Governor Mike Parson. Then, how childcare workers are weathering the storm that is COVID-19. But first, Jim McLean from the Kansas News Service joins me from Topeka to talk about that remarkable state Supreme Court session over the weekend and what that means for Governor Laura Kelly and the legislature as we move forward. Jim, good morning.
Good morning, Steve.
Tell me about this unique hearing that was held Saturday morning, Jim.
Well, it was unique, Steve. I've been covering Kansas state government for almost 40 years. I've never seen anything quite like it. The justices were all home, but they convened on a video conference call dressed in their robes to hear arguments from lawyers who were zooming in from, you know, who knows where.
There were lots of big issues like religious freedom, but the justices decided this case on a very narrow question.
That's exactly right. The case was decided on what amounts to a technicality, a problem with the Legislative Coordinating Council's timing. That's the Republican-led leadership committee that last week at least voted to revoke Governor Kelly's order that brought church services under the statewide ban on gatherings of more than 10 people. Well, as it turns out, Steve, the LCC doesn't have the authority to review any of the governor's orders unless and until the State Finance Council extends the current state of emergency past May 1st. So the bigger questions about religious rights and whether the governor's order trampled on them, the court didn't touch those.
How surprised were legislative leaders about this ruling?
You know, it's hard to say. I mean, some of their reactions were muted. The governor's reaction certainly was muted. She knew that she won a narrow victory and not a larger one. And, you know, the relationship between the governor and these Republican leaders, it depends on who you're talking about. For instance, if you're talking about Senate President Susan Weigel, the relationship between Weigel and the governor is tense, bordering on hostile. But that's been the case for a while because remember, Steve, Weigel is running for the U.S. Senate and she's attempting to please Republican primary voters. However, her relationship with Senate Majority Leader Jim Denning is a bit better. You remember they partnered on the Medicaid expansion compromise. So it's a little bit of a mixed bag.
So I was going to say, what does this mean going forward for the relationship between Kelly and Republican leaders just writ large? What do you see, Jim?
Well, I see a lot of tension still, Steve, and they're still trying to work out how to work together, and I think it depends on the issue. As I say, it's kind of a mixed bag. Denning and Kelly partnered on that Medicaid expansion compromise, but the rest of the Republican leadership remains solidly opposed to it, and they seem to be looking for any opportunity to kind of poker in this emergency setting, and it truly is, I think, a bit of a power struggle.
Okay, that's Jim McLean from the Kansas News Service. Jim, always appreciate it.
Thanks, Steve.
KCUR Up-to-Date special coverage of the coronavirus in Kansas City is extending its service to residents of Northwest Missouri thanks to a partnership with KXCV in Marysville. I want to welcome listeners of KXCV and KRNX and invite you to participate in our conversations each weekday mornings from 9 to 10. Welcome aboard. Two governors, two ways of dealing with the coronavirus. That's one conclusion from the past month as Kansas Governor Laura Kelly and Missouri Governor Mike Parson have worked to deal with the outbreak of the coronavirus in their two states. Of the two, there's not much doubt that Governor Kelly was the most aggressive. Just one example, she was the first governor in the country to close all schools for the rest of the current school year, a step she took several weeks ago. In Missouri, Governor Mike Parson declined to issue an order initially, leaving it up to each local school district to decide how to proceed. On Thursday, he stepped in and ordered the schools closed through the end of the year. Here to dissect the very different approaches of these governors are Burdette Loomis. He's a professor emeritus of political science at the University of Kansas. He joins us via Skype from Lawrence. Bird, always good to have you.
Hey, Steve, how you doing?
Also back with us is Dave Helling. He's an editorial board member at the Kansas City Star. David, good morning to you.
Great to be with you, Steve. Thanks for the invitation.
Professor Loomis, just how different have these approaches been from the two governors?
They've been substantially different. I think that Governor Kelly from the get-go sought to think about the citizens of the state and protect the citizens in a general way as a kind of a first choice. She was a little slower in terms of the social distancing, isolation, but on schools, she was quick. And I think that she's taken her advice directly from Lee Norman, her medical advisor. And I think that has proven to be her touchstone, much as Fauci stands sometimes with, sometimes not so much with Trump at the national level.
David, how do you see it?
Well, I think Bert is exactly right that Governor Mike Parson in Missouri has approached this in a very different manner than Governor Kelly in Kansas. Some people have talked about the resemblance, Steve, between Governor Parson's reaction in this crisis and Governor Jay Nixon's reaction to Ferguson, with the idea being that in both cases, the governors were not completely sure of themselves early on and thought perhaps there was a way to triangulate their way out of this problem by keeping everyone happy without understanding maybe the full dimensions of the problem. I do think since then that people have been able to get to the governor and suggest he needs to be a little more proactive. But, his decision to issue a statewide shutdown came after enormous pressure from other parts of the country. He does seem to be maybe one or two ticks behind most of the rest of the nation in terms of addressing the coronavirus crisis.
You know, Bird, what's been interesting to me is the extent to which these governors are staying true to their ideological roots, even during a worldwide pandemic. Have you noticed the same thing?
To an extent. I think that that's a good basis, and then you have to add some nuance to it. For example, Governor Kelly, until Wednesday, had accepted church gatherings. Then she didn't, and as Jim McLean talked about previously, you had this very dramatic 3 or 4 day episode of Kelly going to court, etc. So I do think that they have come out of their corners. On the other hand, you have governors like Mike DeWine, a Republican in Ohio, being highly regarded in terms of taking the virus very seriously, attacking it early on in terms of substantial measures. So I don't think it's just a partisan perspective here.
I think it's interesting, though, David, that for Governor Kelly hesitating on the churches, taking a stance against holding services on Easter in a state like Kansas, politically, that's a pretty tough nut to crack, isn't it?
Yeah, well, and it's a very difficult decision to reach. Now, remember, Governor Kelly has a challenge that Governor Parson in Missouri does not have, and that is that the legislature in Kansas is controlled by the opposite party, the opposing party, and so all of her decisions are subject to a more skeptical review from Republicans since she's a Democrat. Governor Mike Parson doesn't have that problem, of course. He's got overwhelming majorities in both houses of the Missouri legislature. And so whatever criticism he's faced has come in large degree because of the slowness of his initial response. Plus, I will say that there, and Bert, I think you've probably seen this too, there is starting to be real pressure from the far right of the spectrum to ease the orders, to unleash the economy, that it was all a big mistake, that the estimates are far below what people thought, and it's just like the flu. And so I think one of the interesting dynamics for me in the coming weeks is whether the pressure from the far right grows to sort of back away from some of the things that both governors have done.
Bert, how do you see that that dynamic playing out here?
I think you're looking at two states that are trending in different directions. Missouri, long first a Democratic, then a competitive state, is now becoming more and more Republican. Whereas Kansas, with a Democratic governor, now a House member, and maybe a competitive Senate seat, is trending a little more Democratic. And so I think that Governor Kelly is banking on the notion that she can politically go to the people of Kansas and say, look, I'm protecting the people of Kansas. This is just a temporary order, and I'm doing the best I can for all the citizens. I think that that's a strong political argument as well. And I don't think we're quite seeing in Kansas, not yet at least, some of the demands that you see in other states for opening up quite so quickly.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to up-to-date special coverage, Coronavirus in Kansas City. We're talking about the responses to the pandemic from our two governors, Kansas Governor Laura Kelly, Missouri Governor Mike Parson. Parson, a Republican, Kelly, a Democrat. I'm joined by Burdette Loomis from KU, Dave Helling from the editorial board of the Kansas City Star. You know, David, it's not lost on any of us, I think, that we're having this conversation, as I just had one with Jim McLean from the Kansas News Service, following Governor Kelly's win in the Kansas Supreme Court on Saturday evening. How significant a win was that for her?
Well, I wrote the editorial that we ran on Sunday, Steve, and today, suggesting that that it wasn't quite the victory for Laura Kelly that some people might think, because no one really comes out a winner in these situations. I mean, the idea of closing down Easter Sunday services is not something she or her supporters would want to celebrate. So I do think it's a victory in the narrow sense that it does give her authority in this situation that legislators were and are unwilling to provide. They're just very skeptical of her leadership in this current crisis. And so I do think the Supreme Court, in essence, said, no, Laura Kelly sort of got the reins for now until the legislature takes steps to change the picture. I do want to say quickly, Steve, that we've talked a lot about the coronavirus response, but I do think the economic response in both states will be fascinating. And in that sense, Laura Kelly may be in more trouble than people know. The unemployment situation in Kansas is really disastrous. People are complaining repeatedly about being able to access the website or file their claims. You don't hear that quite as much in Missouri, in part because they modernized their system more recently. So I do think, again, looking forward, once the emergency of the health crisis passes, the economic response will be critical. And in that sense, I do believe the dangers for Laura Kelly are higher than they might be just on her response to health.
Bird, do you buy that thinking?
Certainly from the early reports, that seems to be a possibility. And I think if you had a long-term problems with implementing unemployment insurance, that would be a real problem. At the same time, Laura Kelly did inherit a government that had really been downsized and degraded for 8 years by the Brownback administration. And she has been working to beef that government up. And so she will bear the blame. I'm not suggesting that politically, but we were talking about long-term issues here. And I think that Kansas has suffered from an inattentiveness to governing over the Brownback administration.
But Bird, going back to that Supreme Court ruling Saturday night, this does preserve, to some extent, doesn't it, the ability of a Kansas governor to act aggressively during an emergency?
This is really only a very temporary and very narrow ruling, Steve. And so when the legislature comes back, it can change the rules. And my guess is that it's likely to be more explicit. Some of the legislation was very shoddy, I think. Certainly the LCC's actions were premature. So I'd agree with Dave. It's a narrow victory for Governor Kelly. I'll parenthetically say that the case on Saturday being heard was just fascinating. I thought the lawyering was good, and I was very impressed by the Supreme Court justices, all seven of them. They focused in on this one area of the sequence of the orders. took it to the lawyers for both the governor and the legislature, and then I came out with a really appropriate ruling. And so, in one sense, Kansas government through the Supreme Court really got full marks for its performance on Saturday.
The different ways our two governors are responding to the coronavirus, that's our topic here. If you want to join our conversation, 816-235-2888, or you can tweet us at KCUR Up to Date. You're listening to Up to Date special coverage, coronavirus in Kansas City. David, you know, the Governor Kelly has made a lot of moves here. In late March, she declared a statewide stay-at-home order. As I mentioned, she ordered the schools closed for the rest of the year before any other governor. She also took steps to prevent foreclosures and evictions during the pandemic. She temporarily halted utility shutoffs and blocked large gatherings of people. And she signed orders waiving restrictions on motor carriers delivering relief for COVID-19 and allowing out-of-state doctors to provide telemedicine services in Kansas if they're licensed even in another state. How have her actions been received, and what do we know about all of this sort of writ large here?
I get the sense that there's general support for all of the actions, most of the actions taken by Governor Kelly. I do think she went way out on a limb when she canceled school for the remainder of the year so early. That was a pretty gutsy thing to do. And yet, I think subsequent events have proved her right in that decision. And other governors, of course, are making the same decision. Again, I think that some of the judgment of her actions will need to wait until we see the full extent of the coronavirus epidemic in Kansas and how many people are affected and how the local governments respond. I wrote a story over the weekend, Steve. You know, Wyandotte County is really in a bad way. I mean, they're the most affected county in the entire state of Kansas. And as that continues, and KCUR, by the way, has done some great reporting on this, as that continues, people again will judge her actions based on what happens in places like that. So I think she gets high marks to date, but maybe the final judgment is premature, and probably that's the case in Missouri as well. I think Governor Parson has been making a bet that the coronavirus problem will be less impactful in his state than others think it will be. And that when, you know, a month from now, 2 months from now, people will say his reaction was proportionate. I think that's what he wants to do. You remember, not only does he have a friendly legislature, but he is in the middle of his own reelection campaign. And so politics is probably a more of a part of what his decision-making is about than maybe Laura Kelly's is.
You know, Bert, I can't help but note, I ticked off all these things that Governor Kelly has done. She's married to a doctor, isn't she?
Yeah, a pulmonary specialist.
I just wonder what impact that's had on all this. That'll be interesting to find out someday.
Yeah, I think she's certainly very aware of it. I just like to point out right now that for all the differences in the governors, and I think there may be somewhat fewer differences than we have brought attention to. If you look at the most recent statistics as of this morning on the best website for tracking the virus, Kansas and Missouri are tracking almost exactly the same. If you go per capita, the deaths are virtually the same. Number of cases are a little higher in Missouri, but that's likely because Kansas is trailing almost all states in the number of tests. So honestly, the policies in the two states, as of right now, don't seem to have made great difference. And I do think that in terms of Governor Parson's bet, that might not be a bad one in the sense that many of the states look like they're going to peak somewhat less than was originally predicted.
And the other thing, if I could just quickly, to keep in mind is, coronavirus is, at least at this point, largely, not exclusively, but largely an urban experience. It's a problem in Wyandotte County, Johnson County, Jackson County, St. Louis. There are isolated cases in rural areas, but not to the extent that we have them in the cities and the highly populated counties. And remember, the whole point of the shutdown is to try and prohibit or stop the transmission of coronavirus. And if it works, as everyone hopes it will, then the cases in rural areas will be reduced. You'll have fewer cases out in some of the smaller counties in Kansas and Missouri. That's where Governor Mike Parson is strongest. That's where he has the most political support and where the resistance to shut down orders and closing schools is the highest. So I think he made a calculation, look, if we can get the cities closed down, the spread will slow down, the rural areas won't be hurt as much, and we can keep them open, and therefore I will benefit politically.
816-235-2888 is our phone number here. Let's go to some calls. Elizabeth from Overland Park, good morning.
Yes, I'm commenting on the supposed trade-off. We have to let health go for the sake of the economy. There is no trade-off. We already ran that experiment over 100 years ago with the influenza epidemic of 1918. There were cities that had strong health measures and others that had weak ones. And the ones with the strong health measures also did better with their economy in the long term. So the people who are saying that we have to open up the economy, they're just doing that for their selfish political reasons, not for anybody's benefit.
Burdette Loomis, does that make sense to you?
I totally agree with the policy implications. I'm slower to talk about motivations of politicians. I do think there's an honest disagreement here, but I certainly agree with Elizabeth's analysis completely that there is no real trade-off. And as you said earlier, keeping a lid on rural areas may well help them ultimately, because they'll have fewer cases. So I agree totally. Whether this is pure political calculations, I'm not willing to go there.
Yeah, can I, again, just briefly, Steve, what I find interesting is I don't think that voters, if you're looking at this from just a political point of view, that voters will necessarily judge Mike Parson or Laura Kelly on their immediate reactions to the coronavirus. No one's going to say, well, I'm voting against Mike Parson because he was a day late on his order or a day behind Laura Kelly. But I do think if we look down the road to, you know, September or October, and unemployment is at 15% in Missouri, and cities and counties are laying off people, and schools are having to rescind raises for teachers, and the budget's in deep red, and a special session will be called, then I do think people are going to say, how did you manage this for the long term? And, you know, as I suggested earlier, I think the jury is still out, but maybe that's where the politics comes in, and not so much on the immediate reaction to coronavirus.
You know, I can't help but point out, David, that the editorial board of the Star was critical of Governor Parson early on, saying that he had taken a frighteningly leisurely approach to the crisis. What about that?
Well, we talked about it a lot. You know, I think that we, as a board, believed that the potential damage from the coronavirus was very high, and that other states recognize that. Mike DeWine, which Bird just talked about, other governors, and certainly Laura Kelly, were a little more proactive early on. And so I think our role was to sort of prod the governor on the Missouri side to be a little more attentive to what was actually going on. Let me say he's been pretty, I mean, again, politics clearly plays a bit of a role in this. He announced his final sort of stay-at-home order, the statewide shutdown that everyone was urging him to declare, on a Friday evening at 5 o'clock. He took no questions. and the order turned out to be less than met the eye, which I think some of us wrote about a little bit. So, Bird's right. You have to look at things on the merits. But particularly, I think, on the Missouri side, you have to at least give some consideration to what the governor is looking at politically.
What is Democrat Nicole Galloway, his opponent in the gubernatorial race in Missouri, what is she saying about his approach so far? How critical has she been, David?
She's been pretty aggressive in suggesting the governor needs to move more quickly on some of these issues. But Campaigns have been shut down, Steve. I mean, if you're looking for an exchange between Nicole Galloway, and by the way, the governor took a shot at her in the middle of this, telling her to go back to being an auditor and not really commenting on his actions in this case. But and I think Professor Loomis would agree with this too. On the Kansas side, politics is just frozen in place. I mean, you don't see any discussion, any debate. No one's paying attention to what the candidates are really saying. They're watching what the governors do and reacting in that sense. But the idea that you would now sort of campaign during this crisis is no one's doing it, just no one on either side of the state line.
Again, if you're just joining us, you're listening to Up to Date special coverage coronavirus in Kansas City. We're visiting, that was the voice of Dave Helling with the Kansas City Star. Also with Burdette Loomis, professor emeritus over at KU. Bird, let's step back and look at all this from a national perspective. I can't help but ask how President Trump is faring these days. The latest polls show his job approval dipping. What's causing that? What's behind it?
Well, I mean, I think that, first of all, governors like Cuomo in New York are getting tremendous boosts from their handling of the crisis. Trump has not, even though he's been on TV almost endlessly over the last three weeks. I do think that he provides mixed messages. He rambles at these press conferences. And so I think that what he has been doing is talking to his base, as he always does, which means that it's not likely that he will get the bump. He hasn't gotten the bump that other presidents have gotten when that you have this political scientist called the rally around the flag event.
There was one initially, wasn't there, Bird?
Just a little bit, but not much.
Right.
And what David said for Missouri, I think, goes for the nation. We get into September and October. If we have 15% unemployment, if we have still patches of the virus existing, if we have an economy that's been deep recession for two quarters, I look at those numbers from a traditional political science point of view, and I think that there's almost no way that a president can win re-election. But of course, we're dealing with Donald Trump, and we're dealing with the Electoral College, and so I think all bets are off.
What's Joe Biden's response been, David? Have you seen what have you seen from him?
I think that Biden, like a lot of candidates, has been looking for a path that doesn't distract from the reaction to the coronavirus problem and still gets his name out there. But again, that's a very, very difficult thing to do. He put out a plan in the New York Times yesterday to sort of reopen the economy. All of that will come in time. I mean, all of this will be a late summer, early fall discussion. I think right now, Joe Biden, like a lot of candidates, frankly, he gets a little bit of a break because the people supporting President Trump aren't able to sort of bombard the airwaves with ads and take advantage of their cash surplus, which is enormous. I mean, the Trump people have much more money than the Biden people have. So he needs to raise some money and figure out what his message will be in August and September. But again, it isn't so much, in my view, it isn't so much that Donald Trump will have to defend 15% unemployment, but if the unemployment rate is high, which it almost certainly will be, it takes his whole economic argument off the table. I mean, he can't make the argument this is the best economy ever and the stock market is great and your 401k is healthy. That argument can't be made anymore. And I think that's a problem for Donald Trump, particularly in places like Pennsylvania, Ohio, Wisconsin, Michigan, the key states that we'll be looking at this year.
Bird, there's been a lot of discussion about what the November election will look like if the virus is still around. President Trump and a lot of Republicans say they don't like mail-in ballots. What's their issue, and what do you think the November election is going to look like?
Well, talk about a crystal ball question.
Yeah, right.
I think if we saw even a little bit of a preview in Wisconsin over last week, we should be greatly worried. This is an election, an incredibly important election, and there's going to be ongoing fights about mail-in voting, how to vote, all of that stuff that is now being articulated at the national level. there was an NPR story this morning I thought that was very good that talked about mail-in voting, which is one of the responses here, and talked about whether it advantaged Democrats or Republicans. Said the data show that it's hard to tell that either is advantaged, but certainly Trump is going to argue against mail-in voting. I would say that in many of the states that are the swing states, you have no excuse absentee ballots. In other words, you can ask for an absentee ballot on for any reason. Mm-hmm. And my guess is Democrats will go very hard to get people to vote absentee in those states. But it's really complex. You've got 50 different states, 50 different sets of rules. I don't think we're ready to go to full mail-in balloting. I think that would be if maybe advisable, but almost impossible to implement.
Bert, I'm running short on time. Just a very quick question here. What's the Republicans' concern with mail-in balloting if the surveys show one party's not advantaged either way if a mail-in process is used?
I just think the conventional wisdom, and I'm not ready to give up the conventional wisdom, is that if you have mail-in ballots, it makes voting easier, more people come to the polls, and that traditionally has benefited Democrats. I don't think there are great studies here on this so far, but that's certainly the conventional wisdom.
Okay, we'll have to leave our conversation there. I want to thank Burdett Loomis. You just heard his voice, a professor emeritus of political science over at KU. He joined us via Skype from Lawrence this morning. We are also joined by Dave Helling, an editorial board member at the Kansas City Star. Gentlemen, thanks so much. Sure appreciate it.
You bet.
Thank you, Steve.
After a short break, we'll come back and talk about how the coronavirus is impacting daycare centers around the metro. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to up-to-date special coverage, Coronavirus in Kansas City. And welcome back. I am Steve Kraske. Coronavirus or not, child care centers around the metro are still open. They're watching the kids of essential workers who still have jobs to do. But as it turns out, the number of kids at many centers has dropped, and dropped dramatically in many cases. So how are these centers getting by, and how worried are child care workers about toiling away day after day in child care centers, which some call a germ factory? That's our next topic. With us, Jordan Elo is the Youth Programs Director for Essential Child Care Programs for the Kansas City YMCA. Jordan, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you.
Mary Esselman is the CEO of Operation Breakthrough. That's the Missouri's largest daycare provider. She joins us this morning via Skype. Mary, nice to have you too. Welcome.
Great, Steve. Thanks for having me.
And if our listeners want to chime in, are you depending on child care and how well is that working out for you? 816-235-2888 is our phone number here, or tweet us at KCUR up to date. So, Jordan, how has the virus outbreak changed the way you guys are doing business these days?
You know, from a daily basis, we've got four centers currently operating, three of our YMCA facilities and one school in the Platte County School District that's offering care. And we're seeing anywhere from 60 to 80 kids on a given day.
In each center?
That's total across those four. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the numbers are going up a little bit over the last few weeks. We've seen a slow grow, but it's definitely down from what would be maybe considered a time when kids are out of school and parents have to work. We're definitely seeing lower numbers for sure. And
Jordan, just to clarify, you're only caring for the kids of essential workers right now. Is that right?
Correct. Yeah. Anybody that's an essential worker across the city that needs care, those are the families we're helping out right now.
And Mary, does the same apply to you there at Operation Breakthrough?
That is correct. We're providing care for our parents who are in healthcare jobs or jobs that support healthcare.
So how has the virus changed what's happening at Operation Breakthrough, Mary?
A lot of practices. I mean, when we looked over March and the beginning of April, I think every week we had a slightly different model. But in terms of child care is already pretty highly sanitized because of health and safety. But, you know, we're at a point where parents don't come in. As soon as a family comes to the door, we take temperatures, we sanitize. Age 5 and up, including staff, are now wearing masks. So highly thoughtful about making sure our families and our staff stay safe. But the numbers, as Jordan said, are definitely down because we're just doing that essential care. Another side for us, though, is part of our care to families is also to continue to provide concrete supports. So we also have non-contact delivery of food, resources, educational materials for all of our families that can't be here on a daily basis.
You know, Mary, I can't help but wonder how the kids, the young kids especially, are adapting to this, to see you and your colleagues coming to the door wearing masks and all the sanitizer. Does it scare them?
You know, I think that because it's been a week by week change, you know, it first started out with sanitizer and then we added the, you know, taking the temperature and then most recently the masks. We also have a therapist for our older children, that would be children in kindergarten and up, who meets with them daily just to talk about the kinds of questions they have. And one of the things they didn't like about the masks is they said it's really hard to tell if someone's happy or they're mad and they're uncomfortable. And so what we've said to them is, you know what, we all have to do hard things, and especially when it keeps us safe. And they've really adapted well.
Jordan, what have you found along those lines? How are kids adapting to this new world order?
You know, I think one of the nice things about this right now is a lot of these kids are also talking to their parents at home in the evenings. They are kind of coming to our programs with an understanding of this isn't the most ideal situation, but this is what we have to do right now. And so the kids that we've seen have all been very supportive and upbeat when they come in on a daily basis. And we have the same steps as we've got some behavioral folks that are there to kind of support kids on a daily basis, though, that have questions or just need to talk to somebody about how things are going at home.
How about, Mary, the extent to which the kids worry about their parents who are doing these essential jobs that we talked about a little bit ago? Do they worry about them?
I think they do. We have some children who will say, is my mom coming soon? Is my mom coming soon? I think they also have even some of the questions go beyond their families. I think because some of their circumstances throughout time have been, you know, challenging. We've had kids in the groups that will ask, for example, well, what if someone's homeless? You know, what will they do if everyone's supposed to be staying at home? Or they talk about, what if the stores only let one person in? My mom will get in trouble if we stay in the car. So it's kind of talking through some of those daily situations that maybe aren't just here at the center, but things that they're thinking about in the broader community.
You know, Jordan, both of you have mentioned that the numbers of kids that you're looking after has dropped dramatically from what it was before. I can't help but wonder, with a drop off that sharp, how worried are you about your ability to stay in business?
You know, I think that's been an ever-evolving situation on a weekly basis. You know, we've had lots of different plans to help more kids, and we've had to make adjustments a lot. I think right now everybody that at the Y, we're very much on a week-to-week on how all this is going and staying in contact with health departments and city members about what are best practices and if this is the right thing to do. And, you know, I think that the fact that we've got a demand right now is as low as it is, that tells us that we're helping people out. And as long as we can make sure that we are safe and that everybody that is coming into the facilities are safe and we're following, you know, those steps and protocols, that right now we all feel like we're doing pretty well.
Have you had to lay off anybody, any workers, Jordan?
We have not yet, thankfully, which has been nice.
Mary, how about you? What does this do to the financial bottom line of Operation Breakthrough? And have you had to lay anybody off?
We have not. We are currently able to pay all of our staff. And we have staff that are coming back in, even though they could be at home. And I think that's a true statement of how strongly the staff feel about the mission of making sure that our essential workers can work.
So again, you think you can be, you're going to be in business for a while, Mary?
The only thing that would create the need for us to close is, you know, again, as Jordan said, we follow very closely the health department guidelines. And so we have to be conscious, you know, if we had a positive test, when that happens, we have to close for 14 days.
816-235-2888 is our phone number here. You're listening to up-to-date special coverage coronavirus in Kansas City. We're talking about how the virus is impacting child care centers in the metro. Again, 816-235-2888 or tweet us at KCUR up-to-date. We're wondering, are you depending on child care? How is that working out for you? That's the question on the table here. What about this notion of changes in kids' moods or attitudes as the days pass? What have you seen in your workers? What have you seen in your parents, Jordan? What are you seeing in the kids?
You know, I think the one nice thing that we've been able to pull from is we've got a lot of different activities for the kids on a daily basis. And so the more that we can, you know, kind of engage them throughout the day and things that they want to do, we haven't seen as much of a change with attitudes or behaviors. That's been a real positive is, you know, we've tried to give these kids as they've come in kind of a voice to what they want to see these days. Some of them come in and they've got some homework to work on that they've gotten from teachers in school. And so we're trying to help with that. Others have, you know, other things they want to create and build. And so we've really tried to make this as kid friendly as we can. Maybe even a little more, a little less structure than what we have in the past, but giving them the voice to tell us what they need right now. Hmm. And that's, we've seen a lot of success with that.
A little less structure over at Operation Breakthrough, in your case, Mary?
Well, kind of a mix. We have babies here as young as several months old, all the way up to 14-year-olds. And so for the little ones, we're following very much the same routine. For the older kids, they represent a cross-section on a typical day. When we're full, it's 22 schools. And I'd say now probably at least 10 to 12 schools. And so we're trying to balance what they need to complete for school and then having that free time, as Jordan said, to really explore different interests. We're really lucky that we were able to expand a few years ago and include the Maker City, because that really does give them a lot of areas that they can explore during this time.
I'm sorry, expand to include the what? What was that phrase you used, Mary?
Oh, our Maker City. We expanded our school age program. So, you know, we have 12 different labs from the culinary arts to the makerspace and robotics lab. So the kids really do have a lot of areas they can explore once they finish their schoolwork each day.
Jordan, a question from Barbara on Twitter. How does a preschool differ from a daycare? Are you providing activities for parents who are not essential workers to do with their kids at home?
So all of the four programs that we at the YMCA is operating right now are all school age kids, so kindergarten through sixth grade. We do not have any of our preschool programs currently operating. We have been, though, sharing different activities with families that are typically in our program. We've been sharing things online through via email to help parents if they're looking for resources, and have also offered resources if parents are looking for things for their kids to be able to work on during this time.
Flo from Kansas City, Kansas, Mary, called to ask this question. Any thoughts of asking the state for financial help?
So a couple of the things that are helping us right now is Head Start is allowing us to continue to have our funds and to pay our staff. So that's been huge. The state has also been extremely helpful in terms of child care subsidy. For our center, because we are providing essential care, they allow us to draw our full subsidy during this time because we are providing that care. So those have been great resources. And then in addition, it's been amazing how the community has stepped up, not only in helping us to provide those educational resources, but other supports for families who are here or those at home. We try to provide food and other resources to both staff and families when they leave in the evening, so they can actually go home and shelter in place until they come to work the next day, which helps keep everyone safe.
Yeah. I'm wondering, you know, Jordan, how many questions the kids have these days about what's going on in the world, and how do you handle that? How honest with them can you be?
You know, I think it depends on the age group. We've had those questions. They've come up. And I think that, you know, we've been pretty honest with the older kids, obviously, about what's going on. A lot of them already understand what's going on, so they just have some. They ask a lot of update questions on, has there been any updates today, or, you know, does it look like we'll be able to go do this anytime soon? And we have those conversations. For the little kids, it's actually, you know, they're not asking as many questions. They're more interested in how can they support people. They want to be able to make cards for first responders and things like that. They want to be able to contribute something. And so we're definitely seeing both sides of it, though. You know, there are some times that kids have come in and they're concerned about a parent because maybe they haven't talked to mom or dad from working in the hospital for a couple hours. And so they get a little stressed out about that. And we see what we can do as far as making a call to see if we can get anybody on the phone for that child to be able to talk to that parent just to calm them down. But, you know, it's been really nice to see, especially the younger kids wanting to create things in pass to hospitals and things like that for patients and for workers.
And do you allow the kids to make up cards, and do you send them off to Truman Medical Center or St. Luke's or wherever?
We have, we've let the kids make them, and then we take them to the hospitals and we let the hospital decide if they're passing them out. Some have just taken photos of those cards. And then they've posted them in break rooms and things like that, but we're leaving it up to the hospitals. And we've told the kids that we've got the YMCA and Olathe right across from the hospital there. And, we'll let them decide on if they're passing them out or just placing them somewhere so people can look at and get a smile on their face for the day.
Mary, how are you handling all the questions you're getting asked from the kids themselves?
So we have some group meetings each day with each age group, starting with our kindergartners and older. We don't see as many questions with our preschoolers and our younger children. So that's an opportunity to kind of ask questions. Early questions were really more about where did it come from and those types of questions. And then more recently, it's just more as things change in the community, those questions. We've also had the interesting experience where kids really want to help. And so we give our older kids a chance each day when our harvesters order comes in or donations come in to help prepare the bags that are going to be distributed to families. So they really see not only that opportunity where they can all be helpful in this in different ways for not only their own families, but other families in the community.
I mean, that's pretty endearing, Mary. I mean, just this notion that the kids almost seem to have an instinct that they want to help out at a time like this.
It really is neat to see.
Yeah. What about, Jordan, what about social distancing right now for these kids? How hard is it for them to keep a few feet apart? How important and to what extent can they abide by hand washing, increasing, and not touching their faces, that kind of thing?
Yeah, that's kind of the number one thing right now is, you know, keeping the kids in the same groups that they're in, but also in a smaller numbered group. So you've got the interactions. A lot of our kids making jokes at this point about all the hand washing they have to do. Most of them catch themselves, oh, I scratched my face, I need to go wash my hands. So it's just kind of, they're getting used to it more and more. You know, I think we focused on hygiene in the past, but I think everybody out of this will wash their hands quite a bit more going forward.
But can you keep the young ones, the little ones apart, 6 feet apart, or is that, how challenging is that?
That is challenging. You know, they want to show each other, talk to each other, and it's really just asking them to, you know, giving them activities where they're spaced out. So we're not creating a situation where everybody's got to be at one table. We've got five or six tables spaced out and they're able to work in space rather than right on top of each other, which is, you know, kind of the benefit right now of having lower numbers. We don't have as many kids. We've got a lot more space to be able to follow these social distancing steps.
Yeah. Mary, how tough has it been at Operation Breakthrough to keep the kids in a social distancing kind of mode?
Well, the nice thing is because we're used to having, you know, 350 and, you know, in the school age right now, it's typically closer to 30 or 35 in that section. They kind of use that airplane approach, you know, arms out. Can anyone, you know, anyone touch me with both our arms out? So that's been helpful. And then in the younger children, you know, since the classrooms tend to be more center-based, limiting how many can be in a center, because you're absolutely right. Otherwise, everyone would want to be in the blocks, or everyone would want to be in the same area. And so we've really worked on some of those distancing practices just to help kids. And I think the more it becomes routine, the easier it is to follow.
We're talking about child care centers in the metro and how they're adapting to the coronavirus. Mary, what about when you go home at the end of the day and when your workers go home? How worried are they about spreading something to their own kids or the people you live with?
I think we see it a bit. I mean, everyone's really conscious of it. And I think even more so in terms of going home and not going back out. And even like with our families, you notice when parents come, they're not hugging. They're waiting until they can change their clothes. So, and you're starting to see that change both internally as well as with those we're serving.
That's got to be weird for the kids too, Mary.
It really is. I mean, when I think of all of the different changes in the last month, it just shows how resilient families and kids are. I know it's for our parents, it's been a huge relief. I mean, just the fact that they can continue to go to work, and for our workers here, I think their love of the kids is what brings them back every day, even though they're balancing their own families, because they know for many of them, you know, we're here and that's providing that safe environment.
Jordan, has it been hard for you to keep workers online who are willing to come in and do what they do during a pandemic?
You know, like Mary said, the big thing that family, that our staff is they love being around these kids on a daily basis. One of the steps we put in several weeks ago was we really kind of brought the number of staff down. So we have the same staff continuously working on a daily basis. So we're not seeing a lot of turnover. So we've got about a core of 30 to 35 staff right now that we're seeing in our centers, and we're trying not to rotate that around too much, so that one, the kids know the faces that they're seeing on a daily basis, and we're also kind of lowering that risk, because a lot of the staff that we do have do just come to work and then they go home, and they don't put themselves at a risk by going out again. For the most part, unless they absolutely have to, that way they can be there, and we're keeping everybody safe and healthy right now.
Okay, we'll leave our conversation there. That was the voice of Jordan Elo. He's the Youth Programs Director for Essential Child Care Programs for the Kansas City YMCA. We were also joined by Mary Esselman. She's the CEO of Operation Breakthrough, Missouri's largest daycare provider. She joined us via Skype. Thank you both for a good conversation. I appreciate it. That's musician Rex Hobart playing a live show at what appears to be the Ship in the West Bottoms last Tuesday, but it's actually his basement where he's created a replica of the stage at the Ship. And those crowd noises you heard at the end, they were actually playing off an iPad. Scott Rex Hobart from Rex Hobart and the Misery Boys joins us now. Scott, nice to have you. Welcome.
Hey, thanks, Steve. Thanks for having me.
I guess you should go by Rex, right?
Yeah, sure. Let's do that.
Fill us in here. What were you thinking behind this elaborate Facebook Live concert you pulled off last week?
Well, so for years we've been playing a First Tuesday Honky Tonk country gig down at the Ship. And in fact, every Tuesday they have stuff. And, you know, I was just kind of twiddling my thumbs probably like everybody else and thought, well, oh yeah, there's people doing this Facebook Live thing. Maybe I'll do that. And then I thought, well, heck, you know, I build sets for the Coterie Theater on the side. And I thought, well, I've got some parts. I'll just throw something together and see if I can make it look like the stage at the Ship. And then it just snowballed from there.
And how close do you think you came?
I think it looks pretty good in the videos. And I was joking with one of my bandmates that I think the Facebook Live kind of – jankiness sort of served us as well as the bartender Brian ever does down there. So,
well, it kind of feels like a party when you watch it, which is really different from other Facebook Live concerts these days, it seems to me.
Yeah, it was really interesting. I figured, you know, some regulars would tune in, and then when I got off and saw, you know, just kind of read through the conversation, the back and forth, it was way more social than I sort of anticipated. You know, these are pretty, you always feel like it's kind of a one-sided thing, but it sounds and looks like everybody had a good time. So,
you know, it's impressive to me just how detailed the stage replica turned out to be. I mean, you mentioned your background in building sets for children's theater. Obviously, that seemed to come in pretty handy.
Yeah, I, you know, it's funny. I went on, you know, just sort of Google imaged some images of the ship stage because I didn't have one. And then I ended up talking to Bobby down there and saying, you know, I can't get a good picture of what the painting on the stage looks like and also that banner back there, you know, and he sent me some good close-ups that I was able to work off of. But, you know, if you came over and took a close-up look at closer than 10 feet, you might hang up on me right now. It's kind of the, you know, smoke and mirrors thing, but it does look good at a distance.
You know, I also have to ask why you chose to do it on the exact day and time of your typical performance at the ship when you could have done it maybe on a Friday, for instance. Was that to preserve some sort of same sense of normalcy here?
Yeah, I would say so. You know, and it, yeah, I just kind of, that first Tuesday moment, and I thought people would appreciate it. I mean, I guess I was just trying to be as virtual as possible with any layer I could add. So just the same bat channel and bat time was the way to go, it felt like.
What was the reception to the show like, and do you have another one planned in the future?
Like I said, I was very surprised at how many people tuned in and, you know, I guess it was a captive audience. I'm assuming that we probably would need to do it again next month, at least if not sooner. So, I mean, I've kind of got a couple of ideas that might be fun, you know, to do on the set down there. So might as well use it.
How can people know when you're going to perform the next one?
Well, I just will put it up on the Rex Hobart and the Misery Boys Facebook page.
Okay.
And then they can look at it there.
Well, that's Scott Rex Hobart from Rex Hobart and the Misery Boys. Scott, thanks so much for the good conversation and good luck with future concerts, okay?
Thank you. Thanks for everything you guys are doing over there. Appreciate it.
You bet. We love hearing stories of how you're being creative and thoughtful during this time of social distancing. If you have a story or a thought you want to share with us, you can leave us a voicemail at 816-398-8207 with your name and where you live, or email a voice memo to KCUR producer Mackenzie Martin at mackenzie@kcur.org. Well, you've been listening to up-to-date special coverage, Coronavirus in Kansas City. I'm Steve Kraske. I'll see you tomorrow.